This program does not create an attorney-client relationship between Moss and Barnett, a professional association, or any attorney appearing on this program and any caller or listener. Please remember that we can only give general information, and every case is unique. Always check with your individual attorney for any specific legal concerns. If you are in need of specific legal advice or are looking for an attorney, please do not hesitate to give Moss and Barnett a call at 612-877-5000.
This is WCCO's Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett.
Well, it's a bit of a rainy Saturday for now. Looks like we may see some sun later on in the day. That is good news. The heat and humidity return to the Twin Cities. Tom Schroyer joins us in studio today. We've got a great show, another show that impacts just about everyone, whether we know it or not. People are involved in contracts.
Exactly right, Steve. I was thinking that there may be some canceled contracts for golf reservations today.
Sure.
And a great day for those canceled golfers to be hanging out and listening to our program, which today is called Contract Law 101, a primer or an introduction to the common law of contracts in the United States. And we'll be presenting that with Cecilia Ray. Hi, Cecilia.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Steve. Great to be here.
We're going to be talking with Cecilia Ray, who is a shareholder, a senior shareholder at the Moss & Barnett Business Law Firm. Cecilia focuses her practice on drafting and working with, negotiating, and enforcing complex commercial contracts, which is a bit of a mouthful, but I'm sure that's that runs the gamut from of many different kinds of contracts, Cecilia.
Yes, and today we're going to talk about the basics of contract, though, and how it impacts everybody's life on a daily basis.
Rhett, I think people have the view that a contract is some mystical, magical piece of paper that has to be prepared in a particular way with magic incantation and sprinkled with pixie dust, but that's not true, is it?
No, not at all. It doesn't have to be in writing, though there are certain kinds of contracts that do need to be in writing. Think of your daily life. You get up in the morning, you go out and get your newspaper. You have a contract with your newspaper company for them to deliver your paper and for you to pay for that service. It starts with that.
And it goes pretty much all day long, right, with the daycare provider, purchasing gasoline, going to work. You have an employment agreement.
That's right. In fact, think of turning on your computer. You've got some contract with your service provider for that, too.
So contracts are everywhere pretty much we face all day long. Now, not all contracts are governed by the common law, which I suppose we could briefly summarize by saying a common law is law that's been created over really many, many centuries by judges.
That's right. What we have with the common law is interpretations made by courts and judges and juries as to how one forms a contract or how one interprets contracts when there is questions about what they mean.
Right, and we're going to be exempting some of the particular types of contracts that are really governed by either statutes like the Uniform Commercial Code that Kevin Bush has talked about so ably here on a number of occasions, or employment law with our own Marcy Frost dealing with those kinds of agreements.
That's right. There are many areas where there are specific laws, be it either our state law or federal law, that govern aspects of contracts. As you say, Kevin has given us guidance on the UCC on this show, and Marcy with employment law contracts.
And we've talked about antenuptial or premarital and postmarital agreements with Ed Weiner as well in another context. So, yeah, contracts exist in many, many different facets and are subject to many different rules. We're talking about the enforcement of, at the common law, of contracts between private parties. And in this country and England, where we, of course, get our common law from, we've had a tradition of freedom of contract.
That's right. And you have you started with a fundamental concept of you have parties to a contract. Can be two, can be more. Doesn't have to be individuals. Could be an individual with a corporation, with some other entity. Could be with the government.
But it can't be with myself, such as my New Year's resolutions.
That's right. That would not be an enforceable contract.
All right. Just wanted to clear that up. And, of course, who would I sue?
Well,
never mind. My wife might have a cause of action.
I was going to say it. I didn't want to go there.
All right. So what are the elements of a contract? We've already talked about that on a global basis, it doesn't have to be in writing, and it doesn't have to be signed and sealed with any sealing wax or magic wording. So what are the elements of a contract?
Well, the first thing is you need an offer that identifies in some specificity what is it that is being proposed. That offer comes from the party known as the offeror. Then there must be an acceptance, which matches the offer, and the acceptance is from the offeree. With offer, acceptance, you need to have also consideration, which is some form of an exchange of promises of performance or performance itself. It could be a payment of money. Those are the fundamental elements, offer, acceptance, and consideration.
You know, contract law in for law students is sort of a mystical subject. It's long regarded as a topic where it's impossible to know any of it until you know all of it, and then it sort of comes together in this epiphany right at the end, just hopefully before finals, first year. And so these elements that we're talking about, they're a little bit hard to get our mind around, I think, when we're just talking about them on the get-go.
Well, you brought me back to my first year contracts class, Tom. Thanks. It was we had a professor from, oh goodness, he was from Arkansas, and he, in his Arkansas accent, he would talk to us about the meeting of the minds, which is where you have acceptance and the formation of a contract between parties. But in truth, there doesn't necessarily have to be a meeting of the minds. It's rather from an objective viewpoint. Was there an apparent agreement reached between the parties on the particular offer and acceptance?
All right, we're going to take a break. We're going to shake hands and agree to come back in a moment. It is Minnesota Law presented by Moss and Barnett. Contract Law 101 in the spotlight on the program today.
This is Sidebar on Minnesota Law.
The truth.
Excuse me, Your Honor. Two youths.
Are you sure this is legal?
You think you know every trick in the book, and they come up with another one.
Did you know Moss and Barnett is a member of Business Counsel, Inc., a network of law firms based in the U.S. and abroad focused on providing high-quality legal services to the corporate business community?
Minnesota Law is presented by Moss and Barnett and returns in a moment on News Radio 830 WCCO.
There's no reason to miss your favorite WCCO programs. Broadcast them at WCCORadio.com.
As promised, we are back. It is Minnesota Law presented by Moss and Barnett. Available online, moss-barnett.com. You can always call our program. The phone number is 651-989-9226. Toll free, 1-866-989-9226. If you have a question about contracts, Contract Law 101 today. By the way, text our studio, 81807. That's 81807. Powered by Home Service Plus of CenterPoint Energy.
Steve, thanks for the intro here. We are going to feature, first of all, the call, or a question rather, of the week. We've been remiss for a week or two in not doing this, so I apologize to the audience. But the question of the week, which we'll answer at the top of the second half hour, at the end of our program, I should say, is this. Can a store be sued for not honoring a promotion, a price promotion on a particular product when they run out of that product in their inventory? Can a store be sued for running out of product on a promotion? And we'll talk about that at the end of the show with Cecilia Ray, who's here today to talk about the law of contracts. We're talking about common law contracts. And, Cecilia, I suppose at one fundamental level, a contract is a promise to do something. And normally we think of a promise as something that we're honor-bound, duty-bound to keep. Does the law enforce every promise?
No, Tom. That, by definition, is what a legal contract is that one that it's a set of promises where the law will enforce the promise, but not all promises are legal contracts. For example, you can imagine that the law is not going to enforce illegal contracts. Another example, I've got a 14-year-old daughter who always wants me to take her to Target. I might promise her that I'm going to take her on Tuesday night, but that's not an enforceable contract.
I can get off of that promise that I made to my son then?
Well, it depends. What was the promise you made?
Well, if it's a promise to provide my son with necessary food and support, can I get out of that promise?
No, that's a legal obligation that you have outside of a contract itself. What we're really talking about is promises that are, again, supported by consideration. If you've already got the obligation, a promise to do it isn't a supportable piece of consideration.
We talk about consideration, and I'm a considerate fellow. I just ask the people I work with. We're not talking about that kind of being a nice person, are we?
No, not at all. We're talking about an exchange of promises and consideration that can be money. It can be a promise to do some act. It can be a promise not to do something that you're entitled to do.
Now, for instance, if I have a lawnmower and I want to sell that lawnmower, and Tom and I have a handshake agreement, I'm going to sell that lawnmower to Tom for $100. And then at some point along the way, I change my mind because Craig, our studio coordinator, wanted to pay $150. Well, sorry, Tom. I'm going to get more money from another guy. Does Tom have recourse?
It's a pretty shifty deal, Steve.
Yeah, it is, but I could get $50 more from Craig.
I understand.
Steve, I'm afraid that you are bound at that point. You have a contract with Tom that it was, you made an offer, I'll sell you this for $100. Tom, on the other hand, accepted that, and it was apparent from your handshake that you had an agreement. You have a contract.
Okay. But if Steve breaches the contract, is he committing an immoral act?
No, we're not talking about morality when we're talking about contract law. We're talking about the business of a transaction. Certainly there's been lots of talk recently about people's foreclosure and decisions to, in essence, breach their mortgage contract. And that can be a business decision should they owe more on their house. But the morality of the decision is not something the law is going to investigate.
Right. The courts are not going to look behind the terms of a contract to decide who's a good person, a bad person, in terms of whether there's been a contract breach and what results from that.
That's right.
Now, in that regard, is it fair to say that some agreements are odious and void just as a matter of being violative of public policy?
Yes, there certainly are certain kinds of arrangements or agreements that would not be enforceable. We talked a little bit about illegal contracts, such as you pay me $1,000 and I'll kill that person you don't like. That obviously would not be something that would be enforceable. Similarly, a gambling debt is not something that you would be able to enforce should it not be paid.
Okay, so we've talked about the elements of a contract. Let's parse that through and talk about the parties to the contract. Can anybody enter into a contract?
Yes, however, there are instances where an individual is a minor. And in the state of Minnesota, that would be under the age of 18. Minors have the capacity to enter into contracts that can be voidable, meaning that they can determine that the contract is not something they want to stay with. They declare that they are not going to be bound by that contract once they meet their majority age. And they then have an obligation, however, to restore whatever value they received under that contract.
How about people who are under some kind of an incapacity at the time they make a contract? And that could be anything from a mental incapacity to an illness. But what if they're suffering from nothing more than being under the influence?
Tom, you're right that incapacity can indeed mean that the individual can't enter into a contract. They look at a court in interpreting this will be looking at the capacity of the person at the time that they entered into the contract. As to being intoxicated, it's unlikely that that will stand as an excuse for the contract that you appear to have entered into.
All right, we have more on the way. Cecilia Ray in studio, Tom Schroyer also in studio, our host, Contract Law 101. By the way, our phone lines are open, 651-989-9226. Toll free, 1-866-989-9226. You can text our studio as well at 81807. That's 81807. And, of course, that service powered by Home Service Plus, an offering of Center Point Energy. We have the news and the weather coming up next at 830 WCCO.
From the Buick Studios, this is News Radio 830 WCCO.
It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett, each and every Saturday at noon. Available online, moss-barnett.com. Next week, we should remind you, a best-of program for Memorial Day weekend. Outgoing Chief Justice of the State Supreme Court, Eric Magnuson, joined us about a year ago on the program. We'll have that for you. Still a very timely information, and that is coming up next week.
Yeah, that was a great show, and so we're pleased, really pleased, to be able to bring that back as Chief Justice Magnuson winds up his tenure in office here. He'll be off the bench at the end of June and returning to private practice. And so we're talking today live with Cecilia Ray, senior shareholder at Moss & Barnett, who features an expertise, I'll say it that way, in negotiating, drafting, and enforcing complex commercial contracts. And Cecilia, we've been talking about the elements that go into making up a contract. We were talking about the element of consideration or the payment term. And, of course, we hear in common everyday life about somebody driving a hard bargain or being outsmarted on a deal by somebody else and having to live with it. Do the judges in these situations care about whether somebody has been, as it were, pushed to the edge or taken advantage of in a contract?
Tom, no. Ordinarily, a court will not at all look into the adequacy of the consideration that's exchanged between the parties. There is a presumption that people make their own bargains, know what they're getting in for. The one exception would be if there's fraud involved.
Okay, and I know we have some statutes, that have been passed by the legislature or Congress that protect people who are considered vulnerable from being taken advantage of, consumer protection laws and the like. But generally, when we're talking about freedom of contract in the common law, the judges are pretty much not going to care about what kind of a bargain people made.
That's right, Tom. It's assumed that you know what you're doing.
And so that is one of the things that fuels our free economy, I guess.
That's right. Freedom of contract.
All right, then. And so as we talk furthermore about the other elements of a contract, we have an interesting example of a situation that's been playing out in the news here for the last couple of weeks, and that's the lawsuit against the University of Minnesota by the former coach here at Minnesota and then at Oklahoma, Jimmy Williams, suing, claiming that he was given a contract to come here, that he quit his job, I think it was at Oklahoma, Steve.
Yes.
And then he moved up here in reliance on that agreement and then had the rug pulled out from under him and was told he didn't have a job.
I read a little about that myself, Tom, and you'll notice from what I read in the paper that he's not suing on the basis of a breach of contract.
And so, but I thought, as I've understood it from at least the newspapers and what I've heard, is that he was called by the coach, Tubby Smith. He was told he was being made an offer. He said, "I accept it," and he took steps to rely on that. Namely, he quit his job and sold his home, etc. Why isn't that a contract?
Well, Tom, it may have been, but the next step is, what kind of contract might it have been? It's one where he probably would have been employed at will, and the employer would potentially have the right to terminate his employment the next day.
And so that's life is full of tough breaks, I suppose, but he still has a lawsuit going. He's arguing to the jury here, I believe, this week.
That's right. Again, not on the basis of breach of contract.
What did he sue for?
My understanding, from what I read in the paper, is that he's suing for tort damages.
For fraudulent misrepresentation.
That
he was snookered on the deal, as you were saying, and thus relied to his detriment on a false promise that he would be given a job.
I think that's right.
And so there's another way to skin that cat, apparently.
Yeah, but not under contract law.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how that case plays out because, of course, one of the defenses that the university is putting up is that they didn't have anything signed and written. And, of course, as we've been talking, that isn't necessarily always required in these circumstances to have a contract.
That's right. You don't necessarily have to have a written document to have a contract.
What are some situations where a written contract is required, where you have to have something that is on a piece of paper and signed by a party?
Yeah, there are those instances where courts do need, and this is by statute here in Minnesota, there are, for example, sales of goods for more than $500, lease of goods where the payments will exceed $1,000, agreements to arbitrate, agreements with the state of Minnesota, agreements to transfer land.
And so those are some examples of where if you don't have the agreement in writing, the court won't enforce it.
That is usually the case, Tom, but there are exceptions even to that. There's different principles of law that might be applied by a court in special circumstances that would still have the court honor the contract based essentially on ideas of fairness in the conduct of the parties.
Now, even if we do have a written agreement, there are, I'm sure, times, and you perhaps see them in your professional life, where the agreements, when you look back to read them, are not clear or don't say what the parties thought they meant.
Yeah, that is most unfortunate when that happens, but it does happen. If you've got a written contract and it's clear and unambiguous and a court's called on to enforce that contract, say the other party, the one who does not want to enforce the contract, wants to bring in evidence that, no, it doesn't mean what it appears to say, but instead this is what was intended. The court won't let that happen. They won't let outside evidence in to change the meaning of clear and unambiguous language.
But in the situation where there is some ambiguity, or there is apparently some maybe even inconsistency, or maybe a contract is incomplete, what happens then when you go into court if you have a breach of contract case?
Tom, in those instances where we do have lack of clarity or some element missing, the court will permit outside evidence to come in to fill in the apparent missing information.
Can you give us some examples of what those things consist of?
Sure. There's been a development over many years, courts ruling on various interpretations and kind of rules of interpretation. For example, a primary rule is a court will determine that they do not want to enforce absurd or unjust results. They'll look at the document as a whole. It's called construing the contract as a whole. They won't focus in on one word or one phrase, but will take an overall view, and they'll be looking at the surrounding circumstances, considering the purpose of the contract. If there were other contracts or agreements that may have been signed at the same time in connection with the same transaction, the court will look at those as part of the whole transaction also.
Would this kind of evidence also include looking at how the parties have acted after they signed the agreement?
Oh, absolutely. That would be a very important piece of evidence that you would have witnesses or the parties themselves come in and give evidence on.
And if this is a particular industry or area of commerce, would, you know, the way that vendors or businesses normally operate in that industry, would that come into play as well?
That's right, Tom. You'd also want to bring in evidence from a qualified expert in the area, in the industry, to establish what that practice is.
I imagine as a lawyer, though, drafting a contract, you go to great extremes to make sure that the contracts you draft are as clear as a bell.
Indeed, Tom, I give it my best every time.
And what do you find is important for making sure that the contracts you work on are, as it were, enforcing and memorializing the party's agreement?
One important thing is the communication between the lawyer and the client to convey what is the intent, what is the transaction itself, because that's what has to be reflected in the document.
As a lawyer, then, you have to make sure to really understand what the client's business is.
That's right.
All right.
All right, we have a phone call on the program, Contract Law 101 today. It is Minnesota Law. By the way, our phone number on the program, as always, 651-989-9226. Toll free, 1-866-989-9226. You can text our studio as well, 81807. That's 81807. Powered by Home Service Plus, an offering of CenterPoint Energy. Tom, you're on the program. Hello?
Yes, this is Tom.
Hi, Tom. Go ahead.
I purchased an antique boat on eBay, and the eBay payment plan was there was no payment. The payment had to be made in cash. And so it, I live in Wisconsin, and the boat was in Texas. So I drove to Texas with the payment, and when I got there, I was told that he had had a better offer for the boat, and he sold it to somebody else.
All right.
Thanks for calling, Tom. Great question. It reminds me of Steve's question, which is, you know, he had a better offer for the lawnmower he was going to sell me. Cecilia, what's the take on that one? The fellow bought a boat on eBay. He was told he had to carry cash down to buy it. He gets there, and there's no boat. So they sold it to somebody else for more money.
Tom, I think we have the same result that we discussed with Steve's hypothetical question, too. I think Tom would also have an action for breach of contract.
He might be able to recover the cost of the mileage and the depreciation on his car to go there and buy the boat as well, I would say.
Yeah, that's a possibility. There's different kinds of measures of damages for breach of contract. One is to look at the expectation interest of the person who's been harmed. And you set out then the court will be measuring the benefit of their bargain and try to put them in the same position that they would be in as if the contract had been fulfilled.
That can be a challenge, though, if you're going to file suit someone in Texas. The caller could take on a huge expense trying to pursue damages.
That, Steve, is unfortunately true.
All right. Catherine is up next on Minnesota Law. Catherine, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question. I have a small business, and in my business I have a product that that I gave to a prospective customer to test it in his home to see how he liked it. This was in December. I talked to him many times, and he was just really amazed with the technology and how well it worked and everything. Now, after 4 months, he won't answer my calls. He won't even, you know, I've sent him a letter. He did respond to that. What rights do I have? There was no contract. Is that an assumed contract, or he won't answer my calls or do anything, reciprocate?
Thanks so much for the call. It's really a terrific question, and I think, Cecilia, this gets into the law of bailment, where personal property has been supplied to somebody on condition that it be returned, and the duty is to return it.
I would agree with that, Tom. So the recourse is, unfortunately, again, we're going to court.
All right, we're going to take a break. We'll come back. More calls in a moment. Dave and Mary are waiting. We have a text as well. Contract Law 101. Cecilia Ray is in studio. Tom Schroyer is our host here on Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. News Radio 830 WCCO.
This is Sidebar on Minnesota Law.
You can't handle the truth.
Excuse me, Your Honor. Two youths.
Are you sure this is legal?
You think you know every trick in the book, and they come up with another one.
Did you know? In 1982, Moss and Barnett attorney Michael Flanagan, representing the Minnesota State Bar Association, played a key role in securing legislative approval for the proposed constitutional amendment, establishing the Minnesota Court of Appeals.
Minnesota Law is presented by Moss and Barnett and returns in a moment on News Radio 830 WCCO.
WCCO, now available crystal clear on 102.9 WLTE HD2, Minneapolis, St. Paul.
Welcome back one more time. Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett, each and every Saturday at noon. And we better pay off that. We had a deal. We're going to pay off our question of the week.
So stopping us here, Steve, we have to answer the question of the week, which is, what is the situation, Cecilia? Can a store be sued when it runs out of the merchandise that it has featured a price special on?
Tom, no. Basically speaking, there's no likelihood that you would succeed in a lawsuit against a store in that instance. Advertisements are generally seen as a solicitation for people to come in and offer to purchase.
All right, great. And we have a call?
Yes, we have Dave. Dave, you're on Minnesota Law. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
recently, well, I was in agreement with some former roommates about me paying for electricity. Every month, they would pay me before I would send them the check. I recently moved out of that apartment, and they owe me money still. One of my former roommates even stopped them and I checked to basically screw me over, as she would
say. All right.
Okay, great. Thanks, Dave, for calling. We appreciate that. So, Cecilia, the question is, sounds like he has had a very gross, clear breach of contract. What can he do?
It's possible, depending on the county that he lives in, that he could go into small claims court, which is a pretty easy process. I agree with you that it sounds like you got a breach of contract. Pursue it to recover your damages.
And the damages would be the amount that's owed on the face of it, plus some interest.
I agree.
Right. And we've talked about how to collect judgments and how difficult that can be with John Rossman and Mike Edmond of our law firm on prior shows as well. So a lot of conversation there.
All right. We are out of time. We apologize to Mary and Emmett, the other callers as well, and our text line. We just won't have time on the program today. Great show, Contract Law 101. Cecilia Ray joining us in studio. Great job. First time on the program.
Thanks. It's been really fun.
We do need to have a promise that you'll come back, though.
What's the consideration, Tom?
We have to negotiate. Well, I'll leave it up to you two to draw up some sort of deal to get Cecilia back on the program. We appreciate it, as always. By the way, next week, Memorial Day, a best of program, outgoing Chief Justice of the State Supreme Court, Eric Magnuson.
It was a terrific show, and I think our viewers will really enjoy hearing it again.
All right, that is next week. Best of Memorial Day weekend here on News Radio 830 WCCO. Of course, Minnesota Law presented by Moss and Barnett each and every Saturday at high noon here on News Radio 830 WCCO.